this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And starting on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, the headline across the top of the page, Rex setting up $20 million health startup fund. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Raleigh. The article runs horizontally across the top of the page. At the far left, there's a picture of a man wearing a black jacket, open-collared blue shirt. The caption reads, Rex's David Strong's goal is to nurture innovations. Rex Healthcare is putting up $10 million and is working to raise another $10 million from investors to provide angel funding, grants, and mentoring to startup companies whose leaders have ideas to improve healthcare. The goal is for Rex to invest in innovations on the front end and benefit from better healthcare devices or technology on the back end, says Rex President David Strong, while also taking equity stakes in the startups that could pay off down the road. Called Rex Strategic Innovations, the organization is structured as a for-profit entity under the nonprofit Rex Healthcare, itself a holding of the state-run University of North Carolina healthcare system. Strong says such subsidiaries are not uncommon, and Rex will account for any gains or losses from the subsidiary under its investment income line item, just as it would for gains or losses in equities investments. The goal is not to compete with venture capital funds, but instead to prepare a fledgling company to be in position to seek venture money. There exists a dearth of investment funding in the hundreds of thousands of dollars range, explains R. Eric Hawkins, UNC Healthcare Vice President of Heart and Vascular Services. Venture capital funds are interested in companies only when they need millions or even tens of millions of dollars, and there is a valley of death between what innovators can fund on their own and when VC managers become interested. That's where the Rex Fund would come in, explains Bobby Helmdag, who was hired as Director of Operations for Rex Health Ventures, a function set up under Rex Strategic Innovations to oversee day-to-day operations of the fund. To Ford Worthy, a partner with Durham's Pappas Ventures, an institutional investor with a focus in life sciences, the Rex Fund makes sense. There clearly is this valley of death, he says. Absolutely, there is this huge need, and this could be a good way to bridge nascent ideas to a point where they can appeal to institutional investors. A group such as Pappas, which manages funds of more than $350 million, makes relatively few seed investments, particularly in companies developing medical devices or in information technology. However, if those companies could get early help, then come to Pappas later, the venture firm might be interested. This could be meaningful and highly desirable for a firm like ours, Worthy says. In addition to angel investments, innovators with little more than a good idea can seek a mentor through Rex. That person would help secure intellectual property rights or set up a company to begin developing the idea into a product. Then later, that same company might apply for angel funding. That's when Rex Health Ventures might take an equity position in the company. The hospital system is a good place to house such a fund because it has direct access to the potential end users of a new product, explains Strong. We can just walk down the hall and ask our doctors if they think something is a good idea, he says. As for a return on investment, Strong does not have specific projections but says, we are not in this to lose money. And for our next article, we move down the page, still on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. This article has a black border around it. Inside that border, at the very top in bold black letters, is the beginning of the headline, Ripple Effect. And then under that, there's a picture of a man sitting in what looks to be a library with rows of books behind him, wearing a tie. The caption reads, Judge Rich Leonard presides over bankruptcy cases in the Eastern District. And then under that, there's the continuation of the headline. Lenders lean on healthy companies forcing Chapter 11 bankruptcies. And this article is written by Chris Bagley with a Dateline of Raleigh. Now, under this article, in the bottom third of this box, there's a graph. The graph is headlined Skyrocketing Trend. And then there's a little paragraph about explaining the graph. Chapter 11 of the U.S. Bankruptcy Code allows restructuring of debt terms and, in many cases, cancellation of lease and employment contracts. While bankruptcy filings of all types have increased since the recession, numbers of Chapter 11 bankruptcies have increased dramatically. The numbers below represent new Chapter 11s filed in the Eastern District of North Carolina, which includes all counties from Wake to the coast. And the source of these numbers is the U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the Eastern District of North Carolina and TBJ Research. Now, in the graph, it's a group of cylinders next to each other. The first one is 2007 with three Chapter 11 bankruptcies. 2008 has 14 bankruptcies, 33 for 2009, 53 for 2010, and 125 for 2011. Growing numbers of Triangle businesses are filing for bankruptcy as lenders pull the plug on loans, providing a stark contrast to modest improvements in unemployment, GDP, and other economic indicators. The number of Chapter 11 bankruptcies filed in local courts has roughly doubled each year since 2007 and is on track in 2012 to hit 200, the highest level in a decade. Chapter 11 is used predominantly by companies and sometimes by wealthy individuals to restructure debts and emerge in better financial health. While other types of bankruptcies have increased since the recession hit, attorneys and business owners say the swifter and more recent rise in Chapter 11s shows that economic troubles are catching up with larger and relatively healthy businesses. Among them are Construction Supervision Services Incorporated, a Garner business whose revenue grew by 35% in 2011 to nearly $26 million. Licton Wade LLC, whose two Class A office buildings near PNC Arena are close to fully leased. Owners of Seaboard Station near William Peace University in Raleigh, who say the shopping center is 96% occupied with solid tenants such as Tyler's Restaurant and Tap Room. 20 of the 56 Chapter 11s filed locally in the first 3 months of 2012 were by companies and nonprofits with at least $1 million in assets. Seven reported at least $10 million. More and more, I'm dealing with people in the upper strata who have been able to hold on for longer, says Richard Sparkman, who represents the Seaboard owners and frequently oversees bankruptcy cases in a court-appointed role as a trustee. What I'm getting now is the upper echelon folks who never ever dreamed they'd ever be in a bankruptcy. A time for adjustments. Companies filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy believe they can become economically viable with adjustments. A bankruptcy judge can modify terms of loans, employment contracts, and leases if he or she believes it will result in a viable company that can meet the modified obligations. In several ongoing bankruptcies, the company filed after missing a single balloon payment, the large final payment at the end of, say, a 3 or 5 year loan. Such companies had been making regular payments with little trouble and in normal times would simply renew their loans or find new lenders to take out the original banks. But lenders have hesitated to renew loans on the same terms, according to attorneys for debtors and creditors. That's particularly true when a loan's collateral, real estate typically, has lost value. Bankruptcy lawyers say pressure from federal regulators and internal auditors has been a major factor. Auditors have increased the emphasis they place on collateral when they evaluate the quality of loans, which are banks' primary assets, the attorneys say. They will also look to the creditworthiness of borrowers, but that's not the first test, says Pointer Spruill partner David Dink Warren, who represents creditors in negotiations and bankruptcies. Now examiners look at collateral first and the borrower second. Bankruptcy filings often follow banks' foreclosure attempts and lawsuits aimed at collecting. Bankruptcy puts such moves on hold, though the judges can make exceptions for creditors under certain conditions. Variety of businesses file. While depreciated collateral is particularly common for the real estate industry, real estate companies no longer dominate bankruptcy courts as they did a couple of years ago, attorneys say. In fact, recent Chapter 11 filers include a detective agency in Dunn, a farm in Greenville, a sports medicine practice in Wilmington, and a company in Research Triangle Park. All have at least $1 million in assets and at least $1 million in liabilities, according to their filings. Some Chapter 11 filers are individuals with too much debt to qualify for other types of bankruptcy. Many are business owners, such as real estate developer Mark Tipton, who potentially owes $66 million because he personally guaranteed loans that his development companies took out but failed to repay. Some bankruptcies can be avoided in cases in which debtor companies agree to accept an equity stake in a creditor company. Such arrangements are relatively uncommon for privately held companies with assets of less than $100 million. Raleigh attorney and bankruptcy trustee Holmes Hardin says, while companies can emerge from bankruptcies, employees who are laid off or left out in the cold, significant job losses are more common when bankruptcy allows a company to cancel a collective bargaining agreement, as American Airlines may seek to do at Raleigh-Durham International and other airports. Job losses also follow when bankruptcy allows a retail chain to cancel leases at unprofitable locations, Hardin says. The wave of local Chapter 11 bankruptcies contrasts with other bankruptcy trends. Numbers of consumer bankruptcies rose into late 2010 and have been falling slowly since then, according to data from the U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the Eastern District of North Carolina and the nonprofit American Bankruptcy Institute. And our last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle. The headline, Summit Leads in Bid to Build Raleigh Hotel. And along with the article, there's a rendering of that hotel, of a proposed Residence Inn in Raleigh. And this article does have a dateline of Raleigh. Summit Hospitality Group's proposal to build a $23 million, 11-story Residence Inn by Marriott in downtown Raleigh will be the front runner when the Raleigh City Council votes on a developer for a city-owned site on April 17. A committee established to review three proposals received in March from regional hotel groups selected Summit as the preferred developer. The hotel would be built on a half-acre parcel known as Site 4, which has long been seen as ideal for a hotel due to its location adjacent to a 1,000-space parking deck and between two of downtown Raleigh's biggest tourist draws, the Raleigh Convention Center and the Progress Energy Center for the Performing Arts. We've always had an eye on downtown, especially the last 5 or 6 years with all the revitalization going on, says Eric Tannery, Director of Development for Raleigh-based Summit Hospitality. It's our desire to be a part of that success. Grant Miachi, manager of the city's Urban Design Center, says a committee of 15 city government employees, designers, and hospitality leaders called through proposals. Besides the proposal by Summit, which is led by former Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau Chairman Doyle Parrish, proposals were submitted by Noble Investment Group of Atlanta and Raleigh Prime Investors LLC of Greenville. All three have experience building hotels in the local market. Summit owns and operates three restaurants and four hotels in the Triangle, including a Residence Inn near Crabtree Valley Mall. Noble opened the 400-room Marriott Hotel adjoining the Raleigh Convention Center in 2008, and the principals of Raleigh Prime, including Thomas Glennon and Sue Glennon, are currently building a 120-room Hampton Inn and Suites in the Glenwood South District. We had three good options, Miachi says. While Summit has hitched its horse to the Residence Inn flag with plans for up to 154 hotel rooms and suites on the downtown site, Noble proposed building a $19 million Hyatt Place Hotel. Raleigh Prime wanted to build a $22 million Hilton Garden Inn. Miachi says the choice of hotel brand had little to do with the committee's decision to recommend Summit's proposal. We look closely at all their valuation criteria in the RFP, Request for Proposals, and in general it came down to the overall budget of the project and which would match the quality we wanted, he says. None of the proposals included appeals for taxpayer assistance other than agreements to either buy or lease parking spaces in the adjacent city-owned parking deck for use by the hotel. Construction of the downtown Marriott Hotel, in contrast, was aided by $20 million in taxpayer money. Site 4 had previously been commissioned for a boutique hotel and mixed-use building called the Lafayette. Empire Properties of Raleigh negotiated to buy the land from the city for $1.44 million, assuming it could meet the city's deadlines. The contract was canceled in 2009 when Empire couldn't obtain a loan for the project. Dennis Edwards, president and CEO of the Greater Raleigh CVB, says he was not part of the selection committee for Site 4, but he welcomes any plans to add more hotels near the convention center. Edwards notes that only 755 hotel rooms are available within close walking distance of the convention center, which has hindered his staff from bidding on large conventions. Truthfully, we could use another 400 to 500 rooms downtown, but these 150 rooms would give us the ability to go after groups we have not been able to touch, he says. Groups we are bidding on now are for 2014 and beyond, so even an announcement of a new hotel will allow us to go after these groups. Summit Hospitality's proposal projects that if all the site plan proposals, if all the site plan approvals go smoothly, its hotel could open as early as July 2014, with an anticipated room rate of $126 a night in its first year. That's comparable to what the Marriott and the Sheraton now charge for group business rates, which is around $135 a night, Edwards says. Summit Hospitality's Tannery says a lot of work has gone into the design of the building, which would include a rooftop terrace and 11,250 square feet on the first floor devoted to a restaurant with outdoor seating options and possibly other retail operations along Salisbury Street. Assuming that we are chosen, we are going to do everything we can to make it happen in the time the city wants it, Tannery says. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column, the headline that starts it off, Wrath of Tornado to be Remembered by Harley Outlet. It's been almost a year since a deadly tornado hit Raleigh with storms damaging homes and businesses, uprooting trees, and leaving thousands without power. Ray Price Harley Davidson will mark the anniversary of the tornado, celebrate the rebuilding of a community, and remember the past with a one-year-later tribute. Here at Ray Price, we were fortunate, but not all of our neighbors were, says Ray Price, a former drag racer. Our goal is to recognize what we collectively went through. There were people who lost their lives and their homes in nearby communities, such as Stony Brook, and many of our neighbors lost their businesses. The event is scheduled for Saturday, April 21 at 1 p.m. at the Harley dealership on South Saunders Street. Founded in 1972 as Precision Cycle, Ray Price Incorporated became a Harley-Davidson franchise in 1982. The shop in Raleigh includes a 60,000-square-foot drag racing museum and the Rider's Edge Academy of Motorcycling, along with the Harley-Davidson dealership. Bottoms up! The 7th Annual World Beer Festival will be Saturday, April 14 at Moore Square in downtown Raleigh. Some proceeds from the event will go to benefit Artsplosure for an annual arts festival in Raleigh. Tickets are on sale with the event broken into an afternoon session, noon to 4 p.m., and an evening session from 6 to 10 p.m. Advance tickets are $40 and include samples from a selection of more than 300 beers from 100 breweries. Bands, vendors, and beer training sessions are also available. VIP tickets go for $175, and Biz is told they sell out quickly. The VIP ticket includes a World Beer Festival commemorative glass, a hot food buffet, a private hospitality area, a separate entrance, private restrooms, a gift bag, and a bonus of special beers not available at the brewer's table. The work of Dr. Charles Hamner has been evident for years. Now it's official. He's been bestowed with the Nano Business Pioneer Award for his 50-plus years of service to the fields of science as longtime head of the North Carolina Biotechnology Center. The award was presented during the Nanotechnology Commercialization Conference early this month. Every new community has pioneers, and those pioneers, they do things first with visionary insight. Center of Innovation for Nanotechnology Director Griff Kundall says, Dr. Hamner is one of those pioneers. Biz will toast this. The Roost, the outdoor beer garden at the Farrington Village in Chatham County, will reopen for the spring and summer on April 15, complete with live music by The Boys from Carolina. For consecutive years, the number of 211 calls made in the Triangle declined slightly. Statewide, calls increased slightly from 2010 to 2011. The 211 number is a 24-hour call center that connects people to assistance through health and human service programs. The service is provided through the United Way. Total calls from the Triangle area were 2009, 14,560, 2010, 14,366, and in 2011, 14,310. Statewide, United Way provides the service in 55 counties. Call totals in those counties were more than 58,000 each year. Why the decline? With the economy the way it is and so many more needing help, people could be getting information on assistance through word of mouth and more aggressive agency outreach throughout the Triangle, surmises Lula Johnson, United Way 211 coordinator at United Way of the Greater Triangle. More than 70% of calls were referred to United Way partner agencies and other organizations providing assistance. A supply chain company called Value Outsourcing Solutions has moved into the vacant 280,000-square-foot former Jennifer Convertibles building in Siler City, according to reports from Chatham County Economic Development Corporation. San Jose, California-based VOS hosted a ribbon cutting in early March at the facility, where it will offer a range of services from order processing and fulfillment, packaging, and product assembly. The company has not said how many jobs it will create in Siler City. Chapel Hill entrepreneur Lynn Steinberg, who is also a food reviewer, has turned her love for giving food as gifts into an online store, Goodies for Gifts. The website serves as a virtual storefront for food vendors who subscribe to the service. It's aimed at shoppers looking for something different to give for birthdays, holidays, or other special occasions. Developers of Searstone, a 169-unit continuing care retirement community planned for Cary, have been given until the end of April to submit a financing plan to the North Carolina Department of Insurance. It's the second deadline extension for the documents, which were originally due to the state at the end of February. They had valid reasons, says DOI's Steve Johnson of the second extension. Atlanta-based Samaritan Housing Foundation, which is structuring a $112 million bond package to build the project, is the developer. The 12 Oaks Golf Community in Holly Springs will host its second annual Running for a Cause on April 20 to raise money for the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. Last year's run raised $5,000 for two local charities. Lucy Daniel Center, a provider of mental health services for children, will receive grants totaling more than $1.2 million from the John Rex Endowment. The bulk of the money, $926,479, will go to improve the capacity of child care facilities to develop and sustain policies and practices that support the healthy social and emotional development of children. A second grant of $300,000 has been designated to partially fund the expansion and enhancement of the center's on-site outpatient mental health service for young children, Family Guidance Service, which has seen a dramatic increase in service hours in the past 10 years. On the same weekend as the Final Four, students from some of the world's top business programs competed in the 7th Annual International Tech Strategy Business Case Competition. In the end, a team from Keenan Flagler at UNC Chapel Hill took home the top prize of $25,000. A team from Duke University's Fuqua School placed third. Sponsored by Ericsson and hosted by the Boston University School of Management, the competition focused on the role a networked society could play in innovating education. NC State University is interviewing contractors to oversee the first major overhaul of its Phytotron building in years. The proposed $6.5 million project is to upgrade the 41,000-square-foot research greenhouse facility, will involve the installation of energy conservation measures, improvements to the lighting, and an upgrade of the plumbing and electrical systems. Formerly called the Southeastern Plant Environment Laboratory, the building was constructed in 1968 and was one of the first Phytotron facilities in the United States. It has 60 artificially lighted growth chambers of various sizes to allow researchers to study plant growth at set conditions, no matter the weather or the season. Raleigh real estate developer Austin Williams has found a way to keep busy the last couple of years while waiting for the retail market to return. He's created a jerk marinade sauce that's on the shelves of Whole Foods Market, stores, and other specialty retailers across the state. Called the Shizzle, Williams uses a mix of jerk spices, garlic and hot habanero peppers, and sweet pineapple mash. Contributing to Biz were staffers Jason DeBrun, Amanda Jones-Hoyle, and Lee Weisbecker. And now we'll return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to has the headline, Pension Fund Has $3.5 Billion in Alternatives. And this article was written by Lee Weisbecker with a dateline of Raleigh. Nearly 18% of the $3.5 billion the North Carolina pension system had invested in alternatives, venture capital, and private equity, was in the hands of eight local and state money managers as of mid-2011. That represented a total commitment of $640 million, and it went into 17 separate investment funds offered by the eight North Carolina firms. Pension officials shelled out $6.2 million in management fees to those eight firms in fiscal 2011 to handle the cash. The firm getting the largest fee share, $3.9 million, was Chapel Hills Parish Capital. What did the state get in return? Records newly released by Treasurer Janet Cowell's office covering the 12 months ending June 30, 2011, show that of the 17 separate funds, six were performing at or better than the system's one-year benchmark goal of 18.7%. They were Carousel Capital Partners III, 26%, Hatteras Ventures Partners III, 36.8%, Papa's Life Sciences Ventures IV, 49%, and a trio of Parish Capital Funds, Parish Europe I, 43%, Parish II, 26%, and PCA-SYN Investments, 52%. Hatteras is a Durham-based venture firm that infuses cash into tech startups in exchange for stock. Carousel Capital is a Charlotte-based private equity investor set up by Erskine Bowles, former president of the UNC system. Papas is a Raleigh-based venture investor specializing in biotech startups. And Parish, acquired in late 2011 by New York-based StepStone, invests its cash with other money managers not directly into companies. Charles Merritt, one of the managing partners of Parish, declined to offer an update on the company. Despite the New York acquisition, Parish continues to operate its Chapel Hill office. Looking beyond the one-year time frame on investment returns, the treasurer's record showed that the number of funds outperforming the state's three-year benchmark of 7.02% was four. They are Carousel Partners III, 22%, Dogwood Equity, 53.9%, Inner South Partners VI, 8.99%, and PCA SYNS, 28.8%. Dogwood is a Raleigh-based private equity investor. Inner South, based in Durham, is the region's oldest and largest tech startup venture capital investor. Sinking money into venture capital and private equity is a long-term investment that carries higher risk than some other types of investments. State pension managers consider the shelf life of private equity investments to be 10 to 12 years. Pension fund managers have tended to limit the state's exposure to such investments, historically putting no more than 5% of their cash into the categories. That's a modest sum compared to other public pension systems, which on average have 9.8% of assets in alternatives, according to Keith Brainerd of the National Association of State Retirement Administrators. When alternative investments do hit, the rewards can far exceed those generated by conventional stocks and bonds. That's why they continue to have appeal to investors, says Charles Leedy of Chapel Hill Investment Advisors. Some strategies haven't paid off so much in the last 2 years, but pension funds and endowments haven't given up. As for North Carolina, the remaining $2.86 billion in the pension system's alternatives portfolio in 2011 was scattered out among 49 other out-of-state managers. As of June 30, 2011, the entire alternatives portfolio was showing 1 year and 3 year returns of 14.2% and 0.36%, respectively, both below system benchmarks. Pension officials used their returns to help pay the benefits of thousands of retired state employees. And our next article is in the center of the page. It has a black border around it. Inside that border, the top third has a picture of a house with a for sale sign out front. The caption reads, "Belmont at Cary Park is among D.R. Horton's Triangle Projects." And then under that in bold black lettering is the headline, "Land Rush, Ready Lots Moving Off Market, Prompting Developers to Shop for Fresh Land." And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a Dateline of Raleigh. Big home builder groups such as D.R. Horton and Pulte Homes are getting back into the land development business as the supply of ready lots begins to diminish across the triangle. D.R. Horton on March 30 paid $5.16 million for 127 acres of mostly undeveloped land at the intersection of Buffalo and Forestville Roads in North Raleigh. There, it plans to build a new home community called Bryson Village. Pulte's Centex division in 2011 paid $6 million for 130 acres in Fuquay Varina, where the new Alston Ridge community is underway. Similarly, Lennar paid $5.3 million for 40 acres in West Raleigh, where it is building its Inside Wade community. The trend I'm looking at is the builders who originally were needing a minimum of 100 lots started going down to 50 lots, then 20 lots. Now they're saying, we'll take 10 to 15 lots in the right location, says Jim Anderson, president of Fuller Land and Development in Raleigh, which helps broker land and lot deals for home builder groups. That's a sign that supply is tightening, he says. D.R. Horton president and CEO Donald J. Tomnitz noted in a January conference call with analysts that his company spent $229 million in its first fiscal quarter on investments in land, lots, and development costs. Tomnitz also noted that any investment in lots or land in any of D.R. Horton's markets must fit within the company's 2-year supply guidelines. Our current underwriting guidelines require that with any land that we invest in and any land that we develop, that we get our capital returned in 18 months, sometimes at the worst case basis, if it's a great deal, 24 months, Tomnitz said. Anything greater than a 2-year supply, we're going to be partnering with other land developers and make sure that they hold those lots that will require greater than 2 years as opposed to us holding them on our balance sheet. In the triangle, D.R. Horton ranked at number 3 for the dollar volume of homes sold in 2010 behind Pulte, and MI Homes, Lennar Corporation, ranked at number 4. The land that Fort Worth, Texas-based D.R. Horton purchased for Bryson Village in North Raleigh had previously been under development for Terramore Homes of Raleigh. About 40 lots were completed around the time the housing market started to tumble, but no homes were ever built. Neither D.R. Horton Central North Carolina Division President John Nance nor Terramore CEO and owner Pablo Reeder returned calls for comment. And our next article is written by John Downey with the Dateline of Pittsburgh. The headline, "Huge Solar Field Eyed as Part of Preston Project." Seeking to position itself as the state's leader in developing utility-scale solar projects, Strata Solar has proposed building a 20-megawatt solar farm in Chatham County designed to sell power to a North Carolina utility at a profit. It would be an important step forward for the state's solar industry if Strata can pull it off. The project would be the size of a massive solar farm proposed by Apple Incorporated at its data center in Maiden. But that project is designed primarily to provide power for the center, not as a project to make money from the sale of electricity. Marcus Wilhelm, founder of the three-year-old solar company based in Chapel Hill, has no doubts about the company's ability to build the project, and he expects to have as many as four additional projects of that size in the works elsewhere by the end of the year. The Chatham Park Solar Farm would be part of a 7,000-acre mixed-use project proposed in Chatham County by Preston Development of Cary. The land has been purchased in chunks over the past several years by Chatham Park Investors, a limited liability company involving Preston's owners and top executives at SAS Institute in Cary. Jim Goodnight, CEO of SAS, is one of the principal investors. Plans call for for Strata to lease the property and operate the farm. Philip Culpepper, the consulting planner for Preston on Chatham Park, says the developer believes a large solar project would set the right tone for a development that some in the region have referred to as Research Triangle Park 2.0. "We are looking at attracting people from across the world with Chatham Park," he says. "If you have a company looking at you from Germany, for instance, and solar is not a part of your project, they wonder why not." The solar farm also would allow Chatham Park to bring in some revenue while the large development contracts are being negotiated. Strata would make all the money from the sale of the power, but Chatham Park investors get the proceeds from the lease. For the long run, Culpepper says, Preston wants to establish a continuing relationship with Strata for future solar projects in the mixed-use development. "We have looked at some companies that would be interested in having solar on their roof or as part of their property for their own use," he says. "We want that relationship with Strata to help with solar orientation and the construction of future projects as requested." Randy Perkins, a lawyer specializing in power project development at Moore and Van Allen in Charlotte, says the solar project could be an important development of the industry in the state. He says the low prices offered by power companies in the state for large renewable projects have so far generally put them out of reach for solar developers because financing is not available at those prices. "That is why the sale of renewable energy credits has been key. They essentially raise the price the developers paid for the power, but the market for those credits in the state has all but dried up." Ivan Yurlob, executive director of the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association, says that if the Chatham solar farm can be built without reliance on credits, it would mean the state's industry has taken an important step forward to being self-sustaining. Wilhelm and John Morrison, chief operating officer at Strata, recognize the weak state of the energy credit market, but they say the project can go forward without the sale of credits and still meet the margins needed to get the financing for the project. Strata is negotiating to sell the power to the North Carolina Electric Membership Corporation. The deal has not yet been made final, but NCEMC confirms it is interested. Strata is not disclosing the expected price tag on the project, withholding that as proprietary information, but the installed costs of solar generally run something under $5,000 per kilowatt. Strata estimates the several 5-megawatt project it is building will cost about $22.5 million each to build. Extrapolating from that, the 20-megawatt project could cost in the range of $100 million, although economies of scale are likely to be bringing down those costs. Cornerstone plots its future on acquisition of drug firms. That's the headline on our next article, this one written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Cary. Cornerstone Therapeutics wants to make a big splash this year and is willing to spend as much as $150 million to make acquisitions. To pull off a deal or deals of such size, Cornerstone, a publicly traded company with a market capitalization of about $150 million, would take on debt to add to its $74 million in cash. Ideally, CEO Craig Collard wants to acquire a company with a product already on the market that can turn about $40 million in sales per year. Scientists in the Triangle know all about drug development. Collard is close to those folks, but he doesn't want to be one of them. Instead, he's waiting at the end of the development line and promises to take drugs into the market. "We are a commercialization company," he says. Founded in 2000, Cornerstone initially took a wide array of drugs to market and grew to a $125 million company in 2010. That changed in 2011. Now, Cornerstone is focused on specialty drugs, particularly those that treat respiratory diseases in hospitals. Cornerstone finalized the strategic shift last year when it sold two non-specialty drugs that combined for about $10 million in annual sales. In addition, Cornerstone acquired Cardiokine, a Philadelphia drug developer, and its main product, Lixivaptan, which treats hyponatremia, a metabolic condition. The moves came at a cost. Using generally accepted accounting principles, GAAP, Cornerstone posted a $1.2 million loss from operations in 2011 after three consecutive years of profits ranging from $7.8 million to $16 million. By non-GAAP, GAAP, measurements, Cornerstone posted $18 million in income from operations, which Collard says is more accurate because of the amortization write-downs that affect GAAP income figures. By giving Cornerstone more of a defined market niche, Collard says he can increase sales without necessarily seeing a whole lot of cost increases. By the time Cornerstone launches its sales force for Lixivaptan, the company will have about 50 sales representatives. That number likely won't change much, even if Cornerstone acquires another company, as those representatives would be able to market all of the drugs in Cornerstone's portfolio. Despite the shift in business strategy, some experts see plenty of risks ahead for Cornerstone. Darren Thacker, Associate Dean over Economic Development and International Partnerships at the UNC Eshelman School of Pharmacy, points out that Cornerstone's main products are each in a competitive market and do not offer obvious advantages over the others. Because Cornerstone is not a development company, its pipeline is only as strong as the products it can license. Going up against strong marketing arms of big pharma companies can prove a tall order, Thacker says. In addition, Cornerstone pays out milestones and royalties to the companies that develop the drugs. In relation to the Cardiokine acquisition, for example, Cornerstone could owe as much as $147.5 million. In total, Cornerstone has contracts that could force it to pay up to $194 million just in milestones. Royalties could come to more, though that would mean higher sales for Cornerstone as well. Investors show they share Thacker's opinion. In recent years, both the NASDAQ Composite Index and the NASDAQ Biotech Index have outperformed Cornerstone. The company's shares trade in the $6 range, well off the 52-week high of $9.20. Collard understands some of the skepticism. "I think that's fair," he says. "We need to show we can get a deal done." The company recently changed its accountant from Grant Thornton to Ernst & Young. And our next article in the Triangle Business Journal is written by Lauren K. Onsorge, with the dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Raleigh's Cherokee intends to nurture clean tech firms. Cherokee Investment Partners is moving beyond its core investment strategy and aiming its wallets at three early stage startups. The deal is similar to one the firm did last year in Raleigh, in which two clean tech companies were given Cherokee mentorship, but this time around, companies will have a full accelerator experience. Three local clean techs will be allowed to share Cherokee office space in Raleigh and will each receive $20,000 to develop their ideas. Applications are currently being accepted for the program, which Cherokee partner Tom Darden hopes will help pull clean techs ahead of the startup pack. Clean techs, he says, face unique challenges as they promote and improve sustainability, particularly energy initiative companies. "You're competing against the government," Darden says. "The utility companies are the government, and the government does whatever they want. If they choose to get into your business, they're going to win, and you're going to lose." They have the ability to raise rates, he says, and startups have to work fast to stay ahead, and there's a lot of competition. As gas prices rise, a lot of companies want to capitalize on cheaper fuel initiatives, he says. That means more competition for investors. Cherokee, launched by Darden in 1985, typically invests about $10 million a year in clean tech companies. He says the accelerator is a way to encourage young clean techs that need a push to stay ahead of the competition. Josh Cohen of Raleigh-based clean tech company TransLock agrees that clean techs can face unique challenges. While his company, incorporated in 2004, is thriving with 20 employees, he acknowledges that it can be tough to get started, partially because of philosophy. Clean techs have to help people understand the vision of what things could be, Cohen says, adding that a concept can't just be environmentally friendly, it has to solve a problem easily and conveniently to appeal to the general public, and that requires education more than marketing. Not all clean techs struggle. Organic Transit, funded by Community Angel Investor, says it's doing well. The company, which creates solar electric vehicles, a cross between cars and bicycles, has taken about 300 orders and hopes to have 20 babies running around this summer, CEO Rob Cotter says. People are interested in the technology, he says, adding that if it's a good idea and solves a problem, it's going to be successful. We've had more offers that we've turned away. People just have to be excited. In wake of $232 million buy, Inc. Research begins trimming. That's the headline on our next article, this one written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Raleigh. Some 9 months after acquiring contract research organization Kendall International, Inc. Research, also a clinical research organization, will close one of Kendall's facilities in Connecticut and lay off 66 workers there. To better balance resources against current business needs, Inc. Research has made the decision to adjust its current staffing and close its old Lyme, Connecticut location by mid-summer 2012, the company said through a spokeswoman. Senior staff, including CEO James Ogle, were not made available for interviews. Two Duke University Fuqua School of Business professors say the timeline of the office closing falls in line with what most companies would do to find efficiencies. You want to show some cost savings right away, says David Ridley, an assistant professor with a focus on CROs, including Inc. Research. If there are going to be layoffs, you want to pull the Band-Aid off relatively quickly so your employees know that it's behind you. If employees think that layoffs happen gradually, they're always going to be concerned that they are next. In July, Inc. Research acquired Kendall, at the time a publicly traded company, for $232 million in cash. And I should point out that's Kendall spelled K-E-N-D-L-E. At $15.25 per share, the offer was a 51% premium on the 30 trading day average of Kendall's closing price. After the acquisition, Kendall executives received a total of $5.2 million in golden parachute payouts. Just 1 year prior, Inc. Research itself went through a sale. On August 19, 2010, private equity firm Avista Capital Partners and the Ontario Teachers Pension Plan acquired the Raleigh company for a reported $600 million. Kendall was based in Cincinnati, Ohio, and the companies combined for 5,000 employees at the date of acquisition. The Inc. spokeswoman did not give information about office locations or employee count as of April 2012, though the company is represented on six continents. The company did not give any business strategy beyond saying that this is part of our broader plan to support our strong business outlook based on customer needs. Looking ahead, William Mitchell, a Fuqua professor on leave at the University of Toronto, says both Inc. Research and Kendall will have to continue to blend. Once you buy something, you have to integrate what you bought into what you are, he says. You have to change them, and you have to change yourself. If you don't make changes, you've wasted your money. In the short term after an acquisition, the new company will look to cut costs, primarily by eliminating redundancies. That only gets the new company so far, however. At some point, which for Inc. Research is in the near future, the new company must offer services that make it different from others in the market. For a CRO, which competes against companies around the globe, that means performing better trials, enrolling better patients, and giving the customer better data. CRO is a pretty complicated space, Mitchell says. The more you can offer a full bundle of services, the more you're going to be able to compete for jobs. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we move to the small business section, where they have the 9-to-5 column. Raleigh-based Patterson's, a provider of integrated global payroll services in more than 160 countries, has opened an office in Budapest, Hungary. With the new Budapest office, Patterson's will be able to expand its footprint into the Central and Eastern European payroll market. Moreover, by deepening its infrastructure in the region, Patterson's can increase its own in-house payroll capabilities and directly serve clients with employees in high-growth markets. The company has offices in the United States, the United Kingdom, France, China, and Singapore. Baker Roofing Company of Raleigh has opened offices in the greater Asheville and Greenville, North Carolina markets. The Asheville office will serve as geography stretching from Hickory, North Carolina to Knoxville, Tennessee. The Greenville market will extend Baker's reach in eastern North Carolina. In Chapel Hill, Greg Jackson and Partners has rebranded itself as Glyph Interface. Just Neem Body Care in Cary has been recognized as Best for the World in a list of businesses with less than 10 employees creating the most overall positive social and environmental impact in an assessment by the nonprofit B-Lab. Just Neem and the other Best for the World businesses earned a score in the top 10% of all certified B corporations with 10 employees or less, and on average 50% higher than the average score of nearly 2,000 other sustainable businesses that have completed the B Impact Assessment. Just Neem is a leader in the global movement to redefine success in business, says Jay Cohen Gilbert, co-founder of B-Lab, the organization that certifies B corporations. Just Neem is among the best in the world at being the best for the world. And now with our remaining minutes reading the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. United adds nonstop flight from RDU to SFO. United Airlines will begin daily nonstop service from Raleigh-Durham International Airport to San Francisco on August 15. Governor Beverly Perdue made the announcement in an early afternoon news conference at RDU on Wednesday. Obtaining more nonstop flights to the West Coast has long been a goal of RDU's air service development efforts. The flight will not only make it easier for RDU flyers to access California, but also will improve connections to Asia. The first flight from RDU will be on Wednesday, August 15, with a departure from RDU at 7 a.m., The flight's arrival at SFO at 9:50 a.m. local time is aligned with outbound Asia flight departures in the 11 o'clock hour. Sale of Rex hits Legislative Committee. Lawmakers now have ink on paper to direct the University of North Carolina healthcare system to sell Rex Healthcare and the Raleigh-based hospital it owns. Members of the House Select Committee on State-Owned Assets took no action and didn't even discuss the proposal, but it's now part of the legislative agenda. The action represents a continuation of a debate that began last year when WakeMed Health and Hospitals, Rex's main competitor, issued an unsolicited bid to buy Rex and take on its debt. Combined, that would have a value of $825 million, but UNC and Rex officials soundly rejected the offer. Quarterback Philip Rivers invests in New Raleigh Gym. D1 Sports, a specialty training facility, is opening a gym in Raleigh co-owned by NFL star Philip Rivers. The facility, which will open in the summer, will be located at 6330 Mount Hermon Road in Raleigh. Triangle Orthopedics and David Thornton, a former linebacker at UNC Chapel Hill, who also played pro football, also will have ownership stakes. Founded by Will Bartholomew in 2002, Tennessee-based D1 has grown to 13 locations and has plans to grow to 17, including the Raleigh facility. Trainers work with anyone between the ages of 7 and 70, and despite the name, are not focused only on athletes in high school or college. Dara issues $10 million in shares. Price falls. Dara Biosciences said it is selling more than $10.1 million in new shares, prompting its stock price to fall 26% Monday morning. The Raleigh-based company said the sale will help to fund the launch of two cancer-related treatments in the next 6 months. The $9 million Dara expects to net from the sale will cover marketing for the company's recently acquired BioNect and Soltamox treatments. BioNect eases skin irritation associated with some cancer treatments, while Soltamox is an oral version of an existing treatment for breast cancer. Also on Monday, Dara said it is issuing warrants to purchase 10.1 million shares of common stock within 5 years. Half of those warrants come with an exercise price of $1 and half with an exercise price of $1.25. Masters champ Bubba Watson selling North Carolina home. High Point real estate agent Tim Taylor's phone has been ringing off the hook ever since the news got out that new PGA Masters Tournament champion Jerry Bubba Watson has listed his summer home for sale. The house is located on High Rock Lake near Lexington. Watson and his wife Angie bought the home in 2009 for $1.1 million, according to Davidson County records. And they are looking to sell it for $1.5 million after making a number of upgrades. And we're going to stop there with our reading of the Triangle Business Journal. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. Our number, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.